Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast. This week we are looking at Asian and emerging market equities with our in-house research team. But before we get to that wonderful content, please listen first to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here, and today we're going to be looking at emerging markets and Asian equity assets. We're going to do so with our head of multi-strategy, Paul Dannis. The interesting thing I think about today's conversation is that often when we're talking about Asian emerging markets, you know, we have a pretty high profile fund manager in, and not questioning their integrity for a moment, but I'm sure our listeners would recognise there is something of a conflict with a fund manager who's paid to raise assets or paid more by raising assets in his fund. So it's always good to sense check the various asset class outlooks with our own internal unconflicted research department, which is why we're delighted to welcome back Paul a few weeks into the job and a returning guest to the podcast already, putting a tremendous amount of strain on him. So apologies for that, Paul. But let's get straight to it with Asian and emerging market assets. The reason I've brought you in is because our sort of strategic effort has concluded with a view that actually we're getting a little bit more cautious on this asset class. And I was wondering if you could sort of lay out what the major drivers behind that more cautious view are, and then perhaps we'll have sort of a bit of a Q&A behind it.
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. So I guess, you know, the first point to make is that, you know, we remain bullish on global equities on a 12 to 18 month view. And, you know, we think emerging market equities on a 12-month view are also going to go up. We just don't think that relative performance prospects for emerging market equities currently look that great. So we would expect to see them broadly keep pace with the global equity benchmark. So we've recently, in our recent asset allocation committee meeting, we've downgraded EM from previously on overweight to neutral. I think that was just really in recognition of the fact that emerging market equities, particularly emerging market and Asian equities, tend to outperform when global growth momentum is improving. We think we're eventually going to get to that point, probably see signs of global growth momentum bottoming out later this year and start to improve toward the beginning of next year, but we're not at that point right yet. Emerging market equities also tend to outperform when the dollar weakens, and I mean, I think we'd expect to see the dollar bull market.
And that relationship's on the basis that, I guess, a lot of emerging markets, corporates, even sovereigns, borrow some dollars to fund their sort of growth projects. So if the dollar's a bit stronger, there's a bit more money sort of going towards debt servicing rather than expansion and jobs and spending.
Yeah, there's a few reasons. I mean, number one, emerging market currencies tend to be more cyclical than the US dollar. So when global growth is in an upswing, that tends to benefit these more, I guess, economically leveraged currencies like EM currencies. So, you know, when you see, you know, the main focus is really on global growth momentum. When that starts to turn down, emerging market currencies turn down with it. So, you know, I think as a result of that, it's not necessarily because emerging market equities are going, or the dollar is going up, that emerging market equities are doing poorly. It's almost like a consequence of slowdown in global growth that's weighing on emerging market equities. But yes, emerging market companies tend to, when the dollar goes up, it makes it harder to pay back those dollar-denominated debts. So most of their foreign currency debt is in U.S. dollars. So when the dollar rises, it does get harder to pay those back. And I think about these emerging market commodity producing regions, when the dollar rises, that tends to weigh on dollar denominated commodity prices. So I think, you know, those are a few reasons. And of course, we're interested in unhedged currency returns. So when the dollar is strong, emerging market currencies are weak, you know, that tends to weigh on your unhedged currency return of your equity portfolio.
Yeah, so emerging market currencies are weak in the face of dollar strength, and we'll wear that as sterling investors.
Yeah.
You know, we are exposed to those EM currencies. So global growth and the dollar, going to be clear drivers in your mind to what happens with Asian emerging market assets. We talked a little bit about dollar and its relationship with growth, but there's presumably other factors as well that will determine the dollar's fortune and therefore, you know, the second round effects on EM. Do we have a view on the dollar from here then?
Yeah, I mean, it's we think it's going to be, the outlook for the dollar is going to be fairly closely tied to the cycle for global growth. So, you know, once we get closer to the point where global growth momentum starts to improve, and, you know, we would expect to see that happen, as I mentioned earlier, probably in the first half of next year, largely on the back of this lag response to the decline in interest rates almost all over the world. Generally speaking, that has a lagged impact on global growth momentum with falling rates, eventually stoking global growth momentum and pushing it higher. So I think once we do eventually get more signs that we're going to see global growth turn higher, then I think at that point you'd see the dollar, which tends to be a less cyclical currency for a variety of reasons. One reason being that just that the U.S. economy tends to be less cyclical than other more manufacturing exposed economies.
Yeah.
Then at that point, when global growth starts to hook up, we think we're probably going to be close to the end of the dollar bull market.
And so, what about the dollar itself as it stands? Does it look like a glaringly expensive currency at this time?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one way to value currencies, you know, from a sort of standard valuation standpoint, would be looking at how the current value is relative to the implied value based on PPP. And if you look at the dollar right now versus...
That's purchasing power parity.
Purchasing power parity.
Remembering my high-level economics.
Yeah, economics. Still got it. So, relative to the euro, relative to the yen, relative to sterling, the dollar is looking expensive on PPP versus all those currencies.
Okay, so the dollar looks like for the sort of short, medium term that it could be a bit of a headwind for Asian emerging market assets. But in time, it's not too far around the corner. The global growth momentum should pick up on the back of falling rates that actually... Asian emerging market assets may have a better time of it, and the dollar might weaken in sympathy. There is many other factors, of course, that could drive emerging market performance. One would have thought, and of course this would relate to global growth, you know, if China really went for it on stimulus, that growth would enjoy a very nice uptick. I don't know what you're seeing in the data on that, or whether you have any reference to how the leadership are managing their, or signaling any stimulus. You know, what is your sort of picture you paint there?
Yeah, no, it's, I think what we just saw, was it last week, that the Chinese authorities announced that effective mid this month, they'll be cutting the reserve requirement ratio for both small and large banks.
And that basically frees up capital for them to lend, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, frees up capital to lend. And they've also been, you know, via open market operations, pushing interest rates lower, both kind of repo, reverse repo rate, the kind of medium-term lending facility rate. Generally, interest rates in China have been moving lower. They've been doing more on the fiscal policy front as well as the monetary policy front by kind of boosting infrastructure spending. And we'd expect to see more of that as we proceed over the next few quarters. But I think, you know, this is, you know, stimulus that it's countering the negative impact from the U.S.-China trade war, but it's not fully offsetting it. So I think, you know, as a result, we're seeing growth in China slow from, you know, where we were from 2016 to the first half of 2018, where China was growing at a 6.8% real GDP growth rate on average, to now it's growing at 6.2%, which was the Q2, the latest kind of real GDP Q2 number from this year. So I think, you know, the U.S.-China trade war is having a detrimental impact on growth in China. The authorities are taking steps to sort of minimize its impact, but it's not fully, their steps are not fully offsetting that negative drag.
Yeah, okay, so they're not sort of really going for it like perhaps in other previous downturns. That's sort of part of their... their sort of long-term sort of strategy, isn't it? They don't really want too much leverage anymore.
Exactly, yeah. They've got these financial de-risking, de-leveraging goals that they don't want to abandon. And, you know, they obviously want, you know, a big focus is on maintaining stability inside the country, so they will abandon those if the backdrop were to get bad enough. But, you know, ideally they would not like to fully throw them out the window and just do what's required to sort of keep the economy going well. It's sort of battling this kind of U.S.-China trade headwind.
And I guess it's another sort of unfair question. Perhaps I haven't asked any that are unfair yet, but the trade one, we sort of come back to this issue, and, you know, presumably most equity markets would enjoy a benefit from some sort of trade deal. Remind us where you sort of see these negotiations going. Obviously, and I'm sure you would caveat it, that it's a relatively low conviction goal.
Yeah.
It's hard to be confident about these things.
Yeah, I think it's tough to, you know, predict politics. But, you know, our low conviction view is that we won't see the trade war escalate to the point where it acts as an insurmountable roadblock to U.S. growth. So I think just, you know, looking at it from the U.S.'s vantage point, you know, Trump realizes that whenever there's been an incumbent president running for his second term, and there's been a recession in the year leading up to the election, or in the previous year, that president has lost. And every time there hasn't been a recession in that period, the president's won. So we think, you know, he wants to make the economy or make sure the economy is in decent shape heading into 2020. On the Chinese side, I mean, you know, as we just discussed, you know, President Xi and the Communist Party, they don't want to abandon their sort of financial de-risking and deleveraging goals, which they would be forced to if the trade war were to escalate in a major way, and they would sort of, you know, need to launch a major credit stimulus to offset that. So, you know, our low conviction view is that we won't see this escalate to the point where, you know, you see it act as an instrumental roadblock to global growth, but there could easily be a miscalculation on either side. That's why it's sort of a low conviction view.
I mean, one of the interesting things about the trade talks, in fact, I would encourage people to have a listen to our podcast last week with Matt Gherkin, the geopolitical strategist at BCA, former colleague of yours, Paul, who sends his regards, by the way. But for those of you who haven't got the time to go away and listen to that, I thought one interesting point was that some are talking about the Chinese side actually not wanting to broker a deal with Trump because that would help his re-election chances and mean they have to deal with him for another term. That is an interesting point and something I'm sure they're mulling over. But as this podcast and this analyst revealed last week, of course, the consequence of Trump not getting elected means someone else does. And one of the serious contenders on the Democrat side is a lady called Elizabeth Warren, who has her campaign to a large degree is built around human rights. And so I would imagine she would be a very tricky customer for the Chinese administration to deal with. So maybe it's a case of sort of better the devil you know when it comes to brokering who Xi eventually wants to sign a deal with. But anyway, we move on from that. Before we get to sort of some other points, I guess summarise and a few idiosyncratic issues. I guess the broad argument as well that supports an emerging market Asian allocation is valuations. Do you see these things sort of eye-wateringly cheap at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the US is really the one standout equity, I guess, region where, you know, valuation is looking on the pricey side, whether it's the Eurozone, UK, Japan, EM, you know, the 12-month forward PE of those regions are all fairly close together. So I think, yeah, valuation is a reason to be supportive on emerging markets. It's obviously got leverage to emerging markets' superior longer-term growth profile than the developed world. So there's certainly reasons to be, you know, to to maintain holdings of emerging market equities. And you know, just to reiterate, we sort of downgraded from overweight to neutral. We're not negative on emerging markets. And you know, I think the reason why we're not negative is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we eventually think we are going to see this global growth uptick coming through. It's just difficult in terms of predicting when that point, exactly when that point is going to come. But we do think it's, we're going to see signs from here toward the end of the year of global growth momentum bottoming out and then eventually moving modestly higher next year. And with that, you know, there's probably room to upgrade emerging markets back up to overweight if we do see signs of that playing out. But yeah, it's just, it's sort of more of a neutral. There's not really a compelling reason to be overweight or underweight EM at this stage.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the sort of sad truth of being unconflicted on the buy side. You know, we don't have to sort of peddle a story that, oh, we've got a high conviction view here, there and everywhere. You know, the reality is there is a very even case for emerging markets. I mean, I would perhaps pick up on another couple of issues. I mean, some may be sort of feeling a little nervous about some idiosyncratic stories. I mean, the Argentina story has resurfaced relatively recently. I mean, how does that infiltrated your view on the asset class?
Yeah, Merval Index, I think it was the, you know, 48% decline in one day, which made it sort of the second biggest decline, I think, since 1950 ever of global equity index. But yeah, I think, you know, Argentina, with each sort of successive crisis it's had over the last couple decades, you know, the impact that it's had on global growth has declined. But one thing to keep an eye on is really the impact that it'll have on Brazil, which is obviously a bigger player and has a bigger weight in the overall EM equity index. Argentina has a very small weight. And Brazil, to be fair, I mean, it's, you know, it has a more important trading relationship with China. It has a more important trading relationship with the US than it does with Argentina, but it still does have an important trading relationship with Argentina. So if there is severe, I guess, pain in Argentina, that will have a knock-on effect on that more important emerging market, which is Brazil. So that's the one thing I think to keep an eye on there, just to see how severe the downturn is and what that means for Brazil.
Okay, I guess to sort of conclude, you've talked about waiting for the growth upturn, the sort of long and variable, the sort of lag move following these interest rate falls. I mean, I know it's hard to pinpoint a date, but are we talking about 2 or 3 years until growth picks up? Do you sort of eyeball the end of this year? Do you feel like sometime next year growth could see recovery? These things will vary and we'll come back and analyze and see how that view has changed. But at this sort of juncture, when do you sort of see growth ticking up and these more cyclical EM, European, Asian assets looking more like an overweight?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, we're going to get signs of that occurring between now and the end of the year. The growth is trying to bottom out. I mean, we've already got sort of preliminary signs with some of the PMIs globally, you know, showing these kind of microscopic kind of upticks in the previous month. You know, I think it's not going to be clear that we're going to get an improvement in global growth. Not going to start looking like a trend until probably sometime in the first half, early next year. I mean, the key sort of question mark here is how everything sort of plays out on the geopolitical front with trade tensions and also you know, Brexit with here in the UK and the implications for the broader European continent.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Paul. I hope you've enjoyed your first solo podcast. It was a great job, I thought. But listeners, let us know what you think. Why don't you get in touch via Twitter or SoundCloud, leave a review. Please, we welcome your feedback. But many thanks this time for listening, and we look forward to bringing you another update next week. ¶¶